This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 21st of June 2016 on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House coming to you live from Studio One here in London. Coming up,
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but what I know is what we've been able to achieve in this election cycle has been historic.
Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. The GOP is now said to be in open revolt as efforts to seize the upcoming convention gather steam. Meanwhile, if you've ever wondered whether suspected terrorists ought to be prevented from purchasing powerful firearms, here's your answer.
The yeas are 53, the nays are 47. Three-fifths of the senators duly chosen and sworn not having voted in the affirmative, the motion is not agreed to.
The US Senate votes down yet another gun control measure. Plus, is Venezuela really the ultimate result of 21st century socialism? And why a couple of uninhabited islands are causing such headaches for Egypt? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And welcome to the programme. My guests today are Matthew Green, former FT correspondent to West Africa, Pakistan and Afghanistan, and Daniela Peled, acting managing editor for the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both to the programme. First, today to the US, where it seems the rise of Donald Trump may finally be showing signs of weakening. On yesterday's edition of this programme, we spoke about the hints of strife as sponsors and high-profile Republicans bailed out of the upcoming convention. Today, those hints have become reality. The New York Times reports that Mr. Trump's campaign financing trails Hillary Clinton by a massive $41 million, the worst financial disadvantage in recent history. Meanwhile, the list of Republican delegates plotting to snatch the nomination away at the upcoming convention has gone from a handful to well over 1,000. Matthew, an extraordinary story. So what was, I guess, most intriguing is, you know, he was obviously very good at the run-up to this point. Now, at the moment when he has to begin to appear presidential and has to have a network around him, he's an absolute disaster.
Yes, well, this is what's so extraordinary, isn't it, about the Trump campaign, is that he doesn't seem to have any really identifiable strategy, and he hasn't built the campaign infrastructure that every single one of his predecessors had developed by this stage. He sort of wants to kind of bluff his way through on Twitter and through cable news coverage. And that's one thing when it comes to winning the nomination. But it's a very different thing when it comes to a presidential race. And there's obviously huge numbers of leading Republicans who are aghast at the idea that Trump is representing them. And probably quietly quite pleased that he just doesn't seem to have this grassroots organization to back him up.
Not even that quietly.
Well, no, quiet.
And Daniel, it's fascinating because, you know, apparently he's got 70 kind of full-time members of staff. Hillary has 700. He had $1.3 million in cash in hand at the beginning of June. She had, you know, 40 odd million. So what it means is he then becomes very dependent on the Republican machine to kind of bail him out as he goes on the campaign trail, if that happens. So he's kind of going to be held to ransom by the very people who don't actually like him very much.
Well, Donald Trump is not very good news for the Republican Party. I mean, it's really, he's been an extremely divisive force, and it's been quite interesting to see people dancing around being Trump or not Trump. And I think he's going to leave the party in the longer term with a legacy where they've had to actually look at themselves and think, are we a conservative, leaning towards nationalist party with some more swivel-eyed people at the fringes, or are we really a right-wing super nationalist group that's gone out beyond the boundaries of common debate? And this is common to all political movements, and I think
even here in the UK, people look at, you know, Jeremy Corbyn,
exactly,
and they think the leader of the left-wing Labour Party here in the UK, they feel he's probably not electable. But in the end, you know, although there's many people who have machinations about what he represents, they kind of feel, okay, let's just get back and let it take its course, and we'll have to wait 4 years before we start all over again. And you get the sense that many Republicans think, you know, if we stand up against him, we're going to be kind of knocked down by him. We can't change the course of what enough Republicans are thinking, obviously, to get him this far. Let's just kind of sit back.
And the secret hope may be that presuming that Hillary Clinton wins, it'll be a chance to raise and rebuild the party almost from scratch. And the idea that actually it's probably better to lose the election and have a chance to kind of refit the party from within.
Exactly. And that's another parallel, I think, with British politics, the task that David Cameron had to rebrand the Conservative Party away from being the nasty party. And I'm not a Conservative supporter, so I would argue that his changes were mostly cosmetic. But it's a much easier challenge to rebrand your political party from a position where you can be humble and say, well, we're going to learn from our mistakes, as opposed to when you're looking at an absolute car crash of a disaster.
Well, although for the vast majority of Americans watching this race, Donald Trump now is the face of the Republican Party, isn't it? And I suppose that poses the question, doesn't it, as to how far they'll be able to kind of wipe away his influence after the election, presuming he does lose.
We are presuming that.
Yeah, I mean,
what's also interesting is, you know, these populist politicians in any country, yeah, populist isn't quite the right word, because they deal in, you know, populist, you know, policies, but in the end they don't quite get enough people on board. You know, they get the people within their party to kind of like back them. But he doesn't have the kind of breakthrough moment. You get a real sense, you know, that it's not just the media and everybody lined up against him. His own party is kind of lined up against him. And in the end, if you want to break out of that in America, we saw in the last two, you know, elections in the US, presidential elections, the feeling that you had to have the Hispanic vote to win in the end, the changing demographics of America. And here's a guy who kind of like, any chance he gets, he's rude about Hispanics.
Yeah, you know. He's flagrantly insulting many of the grandees of the party. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, actually, as a phenomenon, isn't it? To watch somebody doing 180-degree opposite of what every candidate would be expected to do at this point, which is to sort of, as the heir apparent, to reach out, build alliances, smooth over egos, and create the kind of machine that's capable of delivering victory. We could just hope that this is Trump already starting to implode.
Well, that's sad to say. I think that's part of his appeal, really, that he can say, well, this is the authentic me rather than the party machine. But I mean, that's nothing, nowhere near enough to carry.
So he obviously realizes some of this. So he's got rid of his campaign manager, who we heard there at the top of the show, who apparently didn't really know that he was going to be got rid of until that morning. Within his own team, there have been kind of incredibly incendiary fights about how the campaign should be run. Is he one of these people, as we hinted, you know, that he's very good at the show, but now that it comes to, you know, the reality of the ploddingness that has to get you into the White House, he's just no good at it, and he doesn't have the right people around him?
I don't know. I've spent the last year predicting and hoping that waiting for the implosion, and it hasn't happened yet.
There's a couple of other good facts here. Like, you know, the Trump campaign has not aired a television advertisement since he secured the nomination in May. Clinton and allies have spent $26 million on advertising and TV alone in June. You know, in a way, though, it's not good for American, you know, democracy if you don't have a good candidate in the opposition, Matthew. Is that, you know, you want somebody there to kind of hit back at Hillary, put her on the spot, other than, you know, Mr. Sanders, who's kind of stepping aside now?
Yeah, and there's a question, isn't there, about the whole future of the party system in this age where you can have your Twitter account and your social media, and essentially you don't need the media, or you can kind of create your alternative version. And I guess it'll be very interesting to see what sort of system emerges at the end of all this.
Well, we seem to say this every time the US falls victim to yet another mass shooting. Surely this will change their minds. The aftermath of Orlando was a little different, though. The issue of terrorism entered the gun debate, forcing the US Senate to tackle a bill aimed at clamping down on the easy availability of powerful military-style weapons to those on the terror watch list. Again, the bill was voted down. Again, extraordinary. We heard at the top of the show that clip, which said, you know, here was somebody, you know, who suddenly there was a chance to kind of do something about this, and the US Senate decided not to do anything about it. Daniel, what do you think it says about, you know, the heart of the debate here in America?
Well, it's very, very hard to understand looking at it from a British or a European point of view, and especially a British point of view, because it seems to defy all logic, especially the idea that restricting access to military style weapons. But I'm not even sure that that is the that will make a fundamental difference to the situation regarding gun control in America, because the massive, massive availability of guns means that there's massive, massive amount of gun crime. I'm not sure the statistics. I think 30 people die each each week, or it could be each day, who knows, from murdered by guns in America. And so if you were to remove the, if you were to make it harder to carry out mass shootings, that would, it would have an emotional impact. It would have a media impact. Fewer of those might happen, but the gun crime would continue to be massive. So I think you need a conceptual and ideological shift, which we're very, very far away from seeing.
And do you think that, you know, we're just talking about Donald Trump and, you know, our kind of attempts at getting our heads around, you know, what he means to America and why he has the support that he does. But do you think that perhaps, you know, this, you know, this vote shows, you know, that as Europeans, as outsiders, we just don't understand America in a way, you know, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, even now, even after all this, the issue of the freedom, you know, the right to bear arms is still more important than the question of whether you would allow people, you know, who are potential terrorists to carry guns.
Well, I think in many ways the failure of the Senate to pass this new law is emblematic of the kind of institutional gridlock which has been paralyzing Washington for many years now. We've seen it in the huge financial deficit the country's running up, and in the failure to introduce new infrastructure and a whole host of other issues that need to be tackled. So it's not surprising that a demagogue like Donald Trump is able to point at Washington and say, look, the system is broken, because actually it is broken. You know, if Democrats and Republicans can't get together after the worst mass shooting in US history to actually take steps to stop people who've been on a terror watch list from buying guns in their local supermarket, then clearly something is very wrong. And that's the kind of ground that the Trumps of this world thrive in.
Although they let this happen, it was on a kind of a more complicated point, I guess, in that, you know, in the end, they probably don't believe, you know, we know that most of them don't believe that these people should have guns, but they get caught up in the politics,
yeah,
of it, you know, and they get caught up in the notion that you can carry weapons inside a nightclub to, you know, to potentially, yeah, gun down the other person.
Yeah, yeah, there's this sort of fantasy element to the whole thing as well, isn't there? But it's because Washington has become so divided along bipartisan lines that it's impossible for kind of logic to prevail. And it's just no surprise that people in America are so angry and feel so disenfranchised when their government system just isn't fit for purpose.
Daniela, yeah, it's intriguing watching Obama in his final kind of days in office, as it were. Yeah, he's done really powerful things. He seems to be carrying more Republicans with him, and more sort. But his approval ratings are the highest they have been for a very long time. So he's touching on something that the public genuinely believes in, and many of the public also would like to see some gun control measures brought in. But that strange thing again, that, you know, the people who sit in control of the country don't need to connect with that audience. That they are more concerned about the lobbyists, etc.
Well, yes, I mean, I agree very much. This is to do with the idea of big money and the lobby groups and things that have become just a religion in America, and you can't touch it. And whether it logic, practicality, none of these things make any sense to it. And Obama, for all that he may or may not have achieved, this is not one topic that he's been able to tackle. And he's made some extremely moving speeches, but they haven't gone an iota to shift the opinion of the people that make the decisions.
Well, we're going to leave it there for this moment, because you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Matthew Green and Daniela Pellet. Coming up next, is Venezuela the ultimate result of 21st century socialism? And why are two uninhabited islands in the Red Sea causing headaches for Egypt? Stay with us.
From glitzy dance numbers and well-loved show tunes to conga lines, entertainment is key to cruising success. Monocle's Robert Bound grabs a lounger and joins in the fun.
As night falls, the entertainment starts in earnest. And it's time to start the music, it's time to light the lights and be serenaded by old smoothies, acrobats, the song and dance heritage of white toppers and stilettos, shiny floors and short-skirted high-kicking. Can-can, they sure do. The crowd, they love it.
A cocktail of effervescent words and pictures, Rob's photographic essay is now playing on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House, still with me, Matthew Green and Daniela Pellet. Venezuela once boasted one of the largest oil reserves in the world. The oil, of course, is still there, but there's no boasting. Plummeting prices have plunged the country into crisis. The healthcare system has collapsed. Supermarkets are routinely overcome by looters desperate for food. Those who can still afford to buy supplies must do so under armed guard, protected from swarms of furious rioters. All this amid mandatory daily power blackouts for 4 hours at a time. Daniela, you know, it's a strange shift of politics in Latin America. We've seen, you know, what's happened in Brazil, what's happened across the continent. There's a move away from the left. Venezuela was put up by many politicians, even politicians here in Europe, as a shining example of what could be done when you nationalized industries, when you gave land to the poor. And in the beginning, it seemed to do quite well on the surface, but it was bailed out by huge amounts of oil money. What do we take this as, a judgment of a failure of management of one man, of one system, or does it say something about Latin American socialism and its inability to kind of really redistribute wealth?
Well, if it's looking at a question of 21st century socialism as it was supposed to be remade, it could probably work for a short time with two factors. One, as you said, immense oil wealth. And secondly, a very charismatic leader, which is, for good or bad, which is what Hugo Chavez was, and his successor isn't. It's astonishing that we've reached this situation where Venezuela is being described as a failed state, and on a purely economic basis rather than war, any kind of conflict, which is how we usually expect failed states to emerge. It's extremely bleak. I mean, I'm not an economist, but I can see that the social impact of this kind of period will have consequences for decades to come in terms of education and in terms of healthcare. And so far, we've been seeing this crisis through the prism of these sort of endless media reports of, oh, look, Venezuelan civil servants only have to come into the office 2 days a week, and, oh, you know, this latest crazy story from Venezuela. But it's getting ever more serious. It's not really, there's nothing amusing about it anymore.
Matthew, interestingly, you know, you were based in West Africa for a long time. This isn't a story that's particular to Venezuela in many ways. You know, Nigeria may have begun to sort out its problems, but many African countries, many countries in the region where you were working, West Africa, they had sudden oil wealth. The management of that wealth as it comes online, and even if you try to kind of nationalize it, it seems to be very complicated to make sure that that money is used well, is distributed well, is banked in times of boom and saved for times of crisis.
Yeah, it's interesting reading the reports from Venezuela. I was certainly reminded of living in Nigeria and this spectacle of billions of dollars of oil money just vanishing into thin air. I mean, I think there is a difference, though, with Venezuela, because we're looking at something which is in some respects unprecedented. We're talking about not so much a country that has been held back in its development, like many of the resource-rich African countries, but a middle-income country which is collapsing into a kind of dystopian Blade Runner scenario playing out not far from the United States. And I think it's interesting. I mean, Daniela was saying there's been a lot of cover. I mean, there's been some coverage of Venezuela, but a lot of it's been the kind of clickbait variety. You know, Venezuela has no toilet paper. But actually, the ramifications of this and the spectacle of a country that was a middle-income country turning in on itself in this way is really profoundly disturbing. And it's not a story that I think that has resonated at all, really, in the British media, and certainly deserves a lot more coverage.
I wonder, Daniel, also the interesting thing was, you know, that in the past, many of the neighbouring countries were sympathetic and supportive, whether it was, you know, Cristina Kirchner down in Argentina, whether it was neighbours in Brazil. They were keen to support the idea that the South had kind of rewired itself and was a good opposition to North America. They were keen to give each other some backing. But now as the governments begin to change, as more right-wing governments come into place, you know, that kind of network of support isn't there for Venezuela anymore. And even, I guess, somewhere like Cuba, which is, you know, seen as a kind of a sympathetic brother to Venezuela, they can't really do much anymore. So it's kind of Venezuela on its own, in a sense. I wonder if that's also part of the problem here.
Well, yeah, that's certainly true. And Cuba is on its own trajectory now. Venezuela is very much isolated. And the only thing it seems that the government has to cling on to is that this crisis is not of their own making. This is to do with Washington. I mean, this is the narrative. This is to do with the outsiders, with hostile states, with other hostile states in the area. And this is a crisis not through corruption, not through misspending of oil wealth, not through lack of planning, but this is being, the state is being undermined by hostile enemies. That's the only thing that it's got left with. And the good thing about that narrative, the useful thing about it, is it doesn't need to stand up to scrutiny.
When you look at what Nicolas Maduro has done, so, you know, he's kind of blocked the opposition at every move. He's kind of dragged the country into so many kind of constitutional kind of crises as well. There have been many opportunities along the way for him to potentially have made a more unity government, to have brought people into the fold. Even now, we know that China has been going there to kind of lend money and said that they will loan money to Maduro and to the government there. But they have been meeting the opposition to ensure that if they do lend any money, they'll potentially get it back one day. The betting seems to be against him. Do you think that he could have done things different since the death of Hugo Chavez, or that the populist kind of socialism that was set up by Chavez was just too unbreakable in the minds of the people who were his supporters, who were looking, you know, were dependent on fuel subsidies, who were dependent on food subsidies, who were dependent on all sorts of things coming to their communities?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds very much like the system just wasn't sustainable when you're more or less handing out petrol for practically for free, printing money, running up inflation to, I mean, I think it's projected next year at something like 700%. I mean, people can't afford to eat. The hospitals have got no medicine. I mean, the country is really on its knees. And I think, yeah, I mean, certainly there's been poor decisions taken since Chavez's death. But at the same time, I think the roots of the current crisis go very much back to his rule.
Before we move on, Daniel, when you look, you know the Middle East well, and Matthew, you know Africa well. This correction in the oil price, this collapse of the oil price, it's, you know, now gone up to a more modest element, price, but it doesn't seem it's going to go back to the $100 plus per barrel for a long, long time. What do you think it's done to regimes that you know and watch, you know, throughout the Middle East? Has it been a sensible correction in a way that it has forced governments to act in a kind of more logical way, to stop bailing out every kind of opposition group and trying to kind of quieten people by giving them cash? Do you think in the end it's been a bit of a health check for some of these places, or do you think, you know, we've lost a kind of a generation of people that know all of these different countries?
I'm not sure that that's the case. I think regimes act according to their nature, and that your priority, if you're handing out money and you're following a certain course, an ideologically driven course, then you're going to carry on doing that.
But we see in Saudi an attempt to bring in reform, you know, even in the Gulf states, an attempt to make some attempts at, you know, giving people a little bit more kind of freedom and also taking away some of the things that kind of propped up their lives in the past.
I am yet to be, I'm yet to be convinced by reform in the Gulf, especially Saudi Arabia.
Well, we're going to move on to our final story of the night, because you may think that bickering over two small uninhabited islands might be limited to a couple of hungry pelicans and seagulls, but over in the Red Sea, two land masses have proven particularly troublesome for lawmakers in Egypt. Back in April, the Egyptian president returned the islands of Tiran and Sanafir during a visit by Saudi Arabia's King Salman. The move sparked some widespread criticism and even led to protests, with more than 150 people jailed. Now a judge has reversed his decision, putting the islands back in Egyptian hands. Daniela, it's a bit of a flip-flop of diplomacy, and very strange when we know what happens in Egypt to see a judge moving against presidential decree. What do you make of the story?
Well, it really wasn't a popular decision when Sisi announced it in April, because, you know, the Saudis had just given the Egyptians lots of money, you know, ties being built as ever, and it seemed that this was the gift, you know, handing over control of territory. Never a popular move in the region. Also, I think, though, given the current climate in Egypt, people will seek out whatever opportunity they can to protest. There isn't really very much opportunity for it. So this provided, both the protests in April and the unrest now, I think it provides an opportunity to make your dissatisfaction heard.
Matthew, two bleak rocks sitting there not doing very much. How come they became so important?
Well, this is the great paradox of islands, isn't it? I mean, there's so many examples around the world of countries getting extremely vexed and excised about islands. I mean, think of Britain and the Falklands when the Argentine army invaded. I mean, that turned into a war.
Think of the whole of the South China Sea now.
Exactly, South China Sea. I mean, Spain and Morocco have been at loggerheads. I mean, there's islands. There's something about these little specks.
Britain and Spain with Gibraltar.
Yeah, exactly. That really get us kind of quite upset. And given that, what you have to ask the question, don't you, about the sort of tone-deaf handling of this by the Egyptians, but also by the Saudis, who may have said, look, OK, give us these islands, but, you know, wait 6 months and we'll just do it quietly. I mean, there's a couple, by all accounts, there's a little outpost with a few poor Egyptian soldiers who have probably been there for years, you know, sitting
there.
That's
the early 1950s.
I mean, it's not such a big, you know, this could have been handled so much better.
I think what's interesting about these two, I mean, these two islands, they are quite nearby, at least. You know, it's not like the Falklands. But
they're not going to become holiday resorts,
no,
are they?
No, they're certainly not. For the two uninhabited islands, there was quite a lot of behind-the-scenes manoeuvring before this gift was handed over in April. The Israelis were consulted, the Americans were consulted. I mean, this didn't happen. This wasn't just a parting shot. Oh, you know, thanks for coming, have a couple of islands. So small, but strategic still.
And that consulting is because of shipping lanes or... why are they so strategic?
Well, the Straits of Tehran were famously part of the reason for the 67 Six-Day War as well. I mean, this is a really strategic shipping route through the Gulf.
And I guess also when you come from a country where, you know, you for many years you were hoping to get back the Sinai, the pieces of land being taken from you seems to be so contentious. The idea that you then start giving it away, even like scraps of land, doesn't seem a very good kind of public policy, does it?
Especially not between the Saudis and Egyptians. I mean, relations are pretty good now, but they've always been competition between them, shall we say, over who's going to be the power of the Arab world, who's going to be the leader, you know, the political, the cultural, the religious leaders. So, yeah, this was a bit of a sensitive gift.
And Matthew, when we look at what Sisi is attempting to do here, the shifting tides of who is aligned in the Middle East, you know, it all has a backdrop of Syria still, and, you know, who's backing who. Are these kind of, you know, small outward signs of donating gifts actually part of a bigger story of how people are lining up?
Well, presumably, the Saudis are giving billions of dollars, right, to prop up Sisi's regime. And because we're looking at a pretty bleak economic picture in Egypt, I mean, maybe not quite to Venezuela standards, but not far off. And he needs all the backing he can get. So if it's a couple of islands in return, then I think he's going to make that sacrifice pretty quickly.
Daniel, where does Sisi stand at the moment, do you think, in the popular appeal in Egypt and in his attempts to kind of recreate a more, you know, kind of modern industrial society?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell because opinion polls not necessarily terribly reliable in Egypt, but I do believe he was.
Or in Britain, hopefully.
He was, hopefully.
Yes, we have a large opinion poll story unfolding around Brexit as we speak.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I hope the societies aren't yet comparable in terms of political structure. Not yet. I mean, maybe after if we leave the European Union. But yeah, Sisi was popular. He promised stability, and he does have the backing, not just of Saudi Arabia, but of the United States and the Western world, no matter what he gets up to.
Well, we'll hear more about those two little rock stars, I'm sure, over the coming days and weeks. But that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. The show was produced by Ben Rylan. It was researched by Guy Lutz and by Cy Villafuerte. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next than at 1900 hours. It's our design show, Section D. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. And Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.